This is the second day of this October 2014 seven-day session. We'll return to our text from yesterday, a book called The Practice of Zen, which is a mixture of teachings and autobiographies of masters covering quite a range of history. Yesterday, I was at a loss to say what the years were of the two masters whose autobiographies I was reading, and I looked through the whole book and found no indication. Elsewhere in the book, there's the an autobiography of Xu Yun, who was regarded as the 20th century's preeminent Chinese master. But there's also one in here from the 1500s that we'll get to today. So who knows? Not that it matters ultimately, but it would be nice to be able to put these guys in some historical context. Living in monasteries, they would their standard of living would be so primitive that we wouldn't be able to really tell. I mean, it could be the 20th century and they're still using wood burning stoves and very kind of primitive tools, but we'll pick up again. First, yesterday we read from the, it's not really a full, it's just extracts from the autobiography of a Zen master, Xue Yan. And then we went on to a Zen master, Meng Shan. And where we left off, he had just recovered, somewhat dramatically recovered from a severe dysentery. He had prayed, repenting of everything he had done that was painful and pain-producing, and then he had vowed if he recovered from the sickness, to renounce the world and become a monk, and strive to bring enlightenment to beings everywhere. And then we left off where he had just did recover. By then my recovery was... I sat again and meditated until after midnight. By then my recovery was complete. Both my body and my mind felt comfortable and light. In August, I went to Changning and joined the assembly of monks. There I remained in the monastery for 1 year. Then I started my pilgrimage. On this journey, I cooked my own food. Only then did I realize that the Zen task should be worked out at one stretch. It should never be interrupted. Later, I stayed at the Yellow Dragon Monastery. When I sat in meditation the first time, I became drowsy, but I alerted myself and overcame it. I felt drowsy a second time and alerted myself again to overcome it. When the drowsiness came for the third time, I felt very, very sleepy indeed. Then I got down and prostrated myself before Buddha, trying in different ways to pass the time. I returned to my seat again. By the way, about this is one way if you're feeling really kind of depleted during yaza, and you're not ready to pack it in. One thing, you can do some prostrations, and the kanon room would be a particularly good place to do them. And this, just the activity of it, can wake you up, give you another stretch of sitting. I returned to my seat again. With everything arranged, I decided to surmount my drowsiness once and for all. First, I slept for a short while with a pillow, then with my head on my arm. Next, I dozed without lying down. For two or three nights, I struggled on in this way, feeling sleepy all day and evening. My feet seemed not to be standing on the ground, but floating in the air. Then suddenly the dark clouds before my eyes opened. My whole body felt comfortable and light, as if I had just had a warm bath. Meanwhile, the doubt sensation in my mind became more and more intensified, that is, the questioning of his koan. Without effort, it automatically and incessantly appeared before me. Neither sounds, views, nor desires and cravings could penetrate my mind. It was like the clear sky of autumn, or like pure snow filling a silver cup. Then I thought to myself, this is all very well, but no one here can give me advice or resolve these things for me. Whereupon I left the monastery and went to Chejiang. I hope what people can take from this is that even these quite formidable states of drowsiness can be transcended, penetrated, and just on the other side we can find ourselves in broad daylight. On the way I suffered great hardships, so that my work was retarded. On arrival, I stayed with Master Ku Chan of Chen Tian and made a vow that I would attain enlightenment or never leave the monastery. After meditation for 1 month, I regained the work lost on the journey, but meanwhile my whole body became covered with growing boils. These I ignored, and stressed my work, even to the point of disregarding my own life. In this way, I could work better and gain more improvement. Thus, I learned how to work in sickness. There's a whole chapter in a book with the teachings of Zen Master Hakuin, in which he enjoins a sick monk to take advantage of his condition to sit more than ever. One day I was invited out for dinner. On my way, I took up the koan and worked at it, and thereby, without realizing it, I passed my host's house. Thus I learned how to keep up my work in activity. This is the real challenge for anyone in Sesshin, to take your practice outside the Zendo. Don't check it at the door as you're leaving, but to really maintain awareness of the practice through the work period, the rest periods, the meals, and so forth. This takes practice. Takes perseverance. Usually, for most of us, it takes a whole bunch of sesshins to be able to learn to hold the mind steady outside in activity. Thus, I learned how to keep up my work in activity. When I reached this state, the feeling was like the moon in the water, transparent and penetrating. Impossible to disperse or obliterate by rolling surges, it was inspiring, alive, and vivid all the time. On the 6th of March, while I was meditating on the Wu word, that is equivalent of Mu, the chief monk came into the hall to burn incense. He struck the incense box, making some noise. suddenly and abruptly I recognize myself and caught and defeated Zhao Zhou. Zhao Zhou is the great Joshu in his Japanese name. Zhao Zhou was looked up to as one of the very most illustrious of the Chinese Zen patriarchs. I caught and defeated Zhao Zhou. Whereupon, I composed this stanza. In despair, I reached the dead end of the road. I stamped upon the wave, but it was only water. Oh, that outstanding old Zhao Zhou, his face is as plain as this. For him to say he caught and defeated Zhao Zhou certainly doesn't mean that he saw himself as somehow having surpassed him in realization, but that he saw that he saw through him. As you with genuine awakening, you see through everything and everyone. You find yourself suddenly liberated from the projections of the master or the teacher or your parent or whoever it is. You've got layers of projections wrapped around. I stamped upon the wave, but it was only water. You realize that what seems so substantial is only relatively substantial, largely insubstantial, like water, like our own body, our own body-mind. What is it, 70-some percent water we're composed of? And if our body is insubstantial, how much more so the mind? This mind-body complex that we call I, the self, is in fact more not here than here. In the autumn, I saw Shui Yan at Ling An, as well as, he mentions several other, what he calls, great elders. Xu Chao advised me to consult Wan Shan, which I did. Wan Shan asked me, isn't the saying, the glowing light shines serenely over the river sands, a prosaic remark by that foolish scholar Chang? So he's kind of testing him, seeing how he would respond. I was just about to answer when Master Shan shouted at me, get out! From that moment, I was not interested in anything. I felt insipid and dull at all times and in all activities. Boy, if anyone wanted to be disabused of the idea that an awakening settles your affairs forever, this book, with its many accounts, will do that. It will clarify that having even a genuine awakening experiences doesn't leave us finished. We still have these... one master called these still operative karmas. We still have residual habit forces, tendencies, dispositions, lingering attachments and vulnerabilities, mental, emotional vulnerabilities. Still have these to clean up. There's this wonderful saying I believe it's from ancient China Zen saying, the wind ceases, but the waves still surge. Nonetheless, to have seen, even to a small degree, the illusory nature of the self, the illusory nature of all phenomena, is to be on a whole different footing with these habit forces, to be in a much better position to work through them, having seen that they have no substance to them. It's a huge step forward, even a small step into the first gate. Six months passed. One day in the spring of the next year, I came back to the city from a journey. While climbing some stone steps, I suddenly felt all the doubts and obstacles that were weighing me down melt away like thawing ice. I felt as though I was not walking the road with a physical body. Immediately I went to see Master Shan. He asked me the same question that he had put before. In answer, I just turned his bed upside down onto the ground. Thus, one by one, I understood some of the most obscure and misleading koans. And then he concludes, "Friends, if you want to practice Zen, you must be extremely earnest and careful. If I had not caught dysentery in Chungking, I would probably have frittered away my whole life." So that's the end of the highlights of this Master Meng Shan story. And now we'll turn to a much longer autobiography that we've read before. I still remember Roshi Kapoor reading this. And this is Master Han Shan. And here we do have a date. He was born in 1545. So he was a contemporary of Shakespeare. It was during Han Shan's life that Michelangelo's greatest works were achieved. The University of Berlin was founded. And work began on the Mexico City Cathedral. However, it wasn't finished till 1813. Mañana. That's said with affection after living in Mexico. This one, too, this autobiography is just chock full of strange and wonderful experiences. I sometimes fret that people become attached to these and or even worse, be spooked by them, these experiences that Han Shan had, but all's well that ends well. So I think what recommends reading an autobiography like this, even though it has so many weird experiences that he went through, what recommends it is to see how he would not settle for any of these states that he would settle and go through, and instead would just press on and just slough off one after another until he reached really deep enlightenment. But I'm getting ahead of the story. His mother was a pious Buddhist. She had been especially a worshiper of Guan Yin, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. One day she dreamed that Guan Yin brought into the house a child which she received with warm embraces. As a result, she became pregnant are already off and running with some of the magical kind of thinking of the time. As a result, she became pregnant, and I was born. In 1546, when I was 12 months old, a serious illness carried me to the point of death. My mother prayed to Guan Yin and vowed that if I recovered, she would offer me to the monastery to become a monk. When I did recover, she duly enlisted my name in the, and this is a name, the Monastery of Longevity. When I was 3 years old, I preferred to sit alone and did not care to play with the other children. My grandfather would always exclaim, "This child is like a wooden pole." When I was 7 years old, my mother sent me to school. At that time, I had an uncle who loved me very much. One day, just before I arrived home from school, he died. When I saw him lying so still on the bed, my mother tried to deceive me about his death, saying, "Your uncle is asleep. Don't wake him up." Whereupon I called to my uncle a few times, but he did not answer me. At this, my aunt, greatly grief-stricken, cried out to him, "Oh, my heaven, where have you gone?" Very puzzled, I said to my mother, "My uncle's body is lying right here. Why does my aunt say he has gone away?" Then my mother said, "Your uncle is dead." I asked her, "If one dies, where does one then go?" And from that moment, this question was deeply impressed on my mind. After some time, my aunt gave birth to a child. When my mother took me to see the newborn baby for the first time, I asked, "How did this baby get into the belly of my aunt?" My mother patted me and said, "Foolish child, how did you get into my belly?" From that day on, I was obsessed with the question of life and death. It stuck in my mind and weighed like lead on my heart. See here what an exceptional child he was, that already these things would not just, these questions would not just arise in his mind, but stay there and work on him. When I was 8 years old, I was boarded in the home of some relatives across the river so that I could be nearer my school. My mother forbade me to come home more often than once a month. One day, however, I refused to return to school after my monthly holiday. When I told my mother that I could not bear to leave her, she became furious. She slapped me and chased me to the riverbank. But there I would not leave her to board the ferry boat. In a rage, my mother grabbed me by the hair, threw me into the river, and then turned homeward without once looking back. My grandmother, who was nearby, called for help, and I was saved. Finally, when I reached home, my mother exclaimed, "What's the use of keeping this trash alive? It would be better if he had drowned." After this, she beat me and tried to chase me away. Then I decided that my mother was too stern and cruel, and that henceforth I would not go home anymore. Boy, it just raises a lot of questions, doesn't it? What, was this woman mentally ill? Was she so insightful that she could see that the best thing was this tough love of really pushing him away so that he could, well, actually, yeah, I'm getting ahead. So then I learned later that my mother many times stood alone on the river bank weeping. When my grandmother heard of this, she scolded her. With tears flowing down her cheeks, my mother answered, "I must make him overcome his too affectionate nature so that he can study seriously." Still, I'm reminded of the occasional tragedy we hear about of a mother. I'm thinking of one where she drowned her five kids, or some other mother who's obviously mentally ill, who would kill her child, and there is always such an outburst of ferocious rage in among people who hear this toward the mother, but just murderous rage toward the mother, any mother who would do such a thing. And I tend to believe that a lot of mothers and fathers at times have dark, maybe even murderous feelings come up with their children. I think many, many parents who are very honest would admit that. Never, not that they would ever act on it, but that it's there. It's especially in times of great stress. And then these people who are so enraged at such mothers, these homicidal mothers, just don't want to be made aware of their own impulses. When I was 9 years old, I entered the monastery to study. One day, I overheard a monk reciting the Sutra of the All-Merciful One, or that is, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. Thus I became aware that Kuan Yin could save us from all the sufferings of this world. At this realization, I became very excited and borrowed the sutra so that I might read and study it privately. In 1555, I was 10. My mother was pressing me so hard to study that I was unhappy about it. So somehow she came back into the picture, back into his life. "Why should I study?" I asked her. "To get a position in the government," she replied. This, it seems, was the highest aspiration anyone could have in China for many centuries, is to become a civil servant. This was success and security, financial security. "And what kind of position can I have later in the government?" I asked. Mother said, "You can start in a low position, and it is possible to rise to become prime minister." "Even if I become prime minister," I said, "what then?" "Well, that's as far as one can go." "What is the use of becoming a high government official? To toil all one's life and get nothing is futile. I want to obtain something of eternal value." This is the monastic aspiration coming forth. My mother exclaimed, "Oh, a useless son like you can be nothing but a wandering monk." I asked, "What good is it to become a monk?" "A monk," she said, "is a disciple of the Buddha and can go anywhere in the world. He is a man of true freedom. Everywhere people will give him offerings and serve him." "This seems very good to me. I should like to be a monk." "I'm afraid," my mother said, "that you have no such merits." She's always there for him, isn't she? When I appeared surprised at this, my mother continued, "There have been many Chuang Yuan scholars, champion scholars in this world, but Buddhas and patriarchs do not often appear." "I have such merit," I insisted, "but I was afraid you would not let me go ahead." "If you have such merit," my mother replied, "I will let you go your way." This promise of hers I cherished in my heart. One day in 1556, when I was 11 years old, several persons wearing bamboo rain hats with carrying poles upon their shoulders approached our house. At once I asked my mother, "Who are these strangers?" "They're traveling monks," she replied. I was delighted and observed them most carefully. When they had nearly reached our house, they put down their carrying poles and rested under a tree nearby. They asked us where they could find some food. My mother told them to wait and immediately began preparing food for them, attending and serving them with great respect and veneration. After eating, the monks stood up and shouldered their poles, but raised only one hand to express their thanks. My mother, however, waved them off, saying, "Please do not thank me." The monks departed without uttering a word. I then remarked to my mother, "These monks seem impolite. They did not even say thank you, but just left." "If they had thanked me," my mother explained, "I would have obtained less merit from this good deed." I then said to myself privately that their action showed the supremacy of the monkhood. This encounter encouraged me more strongly than ever in my decision to become a monk. So, yeah, as it says here, there's that strong understanding, or at least traditionally in Asia, that it is by supporting and helping monks that we acquire the merit that will enable us in our next lifetime to become a monk. They're very, very, dare I say, materialistic about this. Very, very determined to bank their merit. And the idea is that to get the full measure of it, you don't want the monk or nun to thank you. In 1557, I was 12. Usually I did not like to mingle with worldly people or take part in their affairs. Whenever my father tried to arrange a marriage for me, I stopped him at once. One day I heard a monk from the capital say that in the monastery of Pao En lived a great master named Shi Lin. Immediately I wanted to go see him. I asked my father's permission to go, but he refused. Then I asked my mother to intercede for me. She reasoned, "It is better to let our son follow his own wish and to help him to accomplish it." That October, I was sent to the monastery. As soon as the Grand Master saw me, he was pleased, remarking, "This boy is an unusual person. It would be a pitiable waste if he became an ordinary monk." At that time, Master Wu Qi was preaching a sutra in the monastery. The Grand Master brought me to the meeting. When Master Da Chao saw me, he was delighted and exclaimed, "This child will become the master of men in heaven." He then patted me and asked, "Would you rather be a high officer in the government or a Buddha?" I answered, "A Buddha, of course." Then he turned to the others, saying, "We must not underrate this child. He should be well educated." Although I did not understand a word of the lecture while I was listening to it, my heart became eager and fervent, as if it knew something but could not express it in words. So it must have been the setting, the context. All of these monks, there may have been hundreds of them, as there would be in a large monastery. It reminds me of reports we get every once in a while on a Sunday after a workshop, and we invite workshop participants to come to our Sunday program. And more than a few times over the years, one of these workshop participants has reported that they just, as soon as the chanting started, they just felt all but overwhelmed, and they had no idea why. Just tears came to their eyes, and it was a very, very powerful experience. We could speculate that these such a person. These people have had previous lives in the Dharma, but it's better just to leave it for what it is, without knowing, without being able to explain it. When I was 19, many of my friends gained honor by passing the official examination. My friends urged me to take the examination as well. When Master Yun Ku heard of this, he became worried that I might be persuaded to engage in worldly affairs. He therefore encouraged me to practice and to strive for Zen. He related to me many stories of the masters of the past and showed me the book called The Biographies of the Great Monks. Before I had finished reading it, I was so moved and exalted that I sighed to myself, saying, "Oh, this is what I would like to do." Thereupon, I made up my mind to devote my life to the Dharma. I then asked the Grand Master to ordain me. Now, the bloom is off the rose here. Discarding all worldly affairs and learning, I devoted myself to the study of Zen, but could not get anywhere. Then he concentrated on very time-honored practice, reciting the name of Buddha Amida day and night without interruption. This is the Pure Land tradition. Before long, Buddha Amida appeared before me in a dream, sitting high in the sky in the direction of the setting sun. So that's his first odd experience. That winter, our monastery invited the master Wu Qi to teach the philosophy of Huayan. So this is like so many Chinese monasteries. This was not a purely Zen or Chan monastery. It was a mixture of Chan and Pure Land and Huayan, three different streams of Buddhism. When the lecture came to the point of the 10 mysterious gates, the eternal realm of the ocean seal, I suddenly realized the infinite and all-inclusive totality of the universe. So deeply impressed was I with a profound admiration for Qing Liang, that's the founder of the Huayan school of Buddhism, that I adopted one of his names and called myself Qing Yin. I then put my understanding before the master Wu Qi. He said to me, "Oh, so you wish to follow the path of Huayan. Good. But do you know why he called himself Qing Liang, which means pure and cool? It was because he used to dwell on the Qing Liang Mountain, cool in summer and icy and frozen in winter." And then Han Shan says, "From that moment, whether walking or standing still, I always saw before me a fantasy world of ice and snow. I then made up my mind to go and dwell on that mountain. Nothing in the world could attract me anymore. The yearning to renounce this world arose continuously within me." Now, on the 16th of January, 1565, when I was 20, my Grand Master died. A few days before his death, he summoned all the monks in the monastery and said, "I am now 83 years old. Very soon I will be leaving this world. I have some 80 disciples, but the one who will carry on my work is Han Shan." Now, he's 20 at the time. "After my death, you should all obey his orders and not neglect his injunctions just because of his age." And then on the in January, he said, "My grandmaster, wearing his formal dress, called each monk into his own room to say goodbye. All of us were much surprised by this action. 3 days later, he settled his affairs and made his will. At the time, he appeared to have only a slight illness. We took him some medicine, but he refused it, saying, "I'm going away. What is the use of taking drugs?" Then he summoned all the monks in the monastery and asked them to recite the name of Buddha Amida for him. We prayed thus for him 5 days and nights. Rosary in hand, he died in the sitting posture, peacefully reciting the name of Buddha Amida. Not long after his death, the room in which he had lived for 30 years was destroyed by fire, as if to give an omen to his followers. All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.